From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Last week, we spoke with Brian McInerney of the National Weather Service, and among other things, he spoke about the area's snowpack and reservoir levels, fair, but improving, given this weekend and today's precipitation.
And who helps manage the soil and the watersheds when our snow begins to melt? Part of the responsibility falls to the state's 38 conservation districts. These districts were established almost 80 years ago in response to the Dust Bowl that occurred in the Midwest due to poor soil management and drought.
Jake Powell is the coordinator of the Upper Weber Watershed, which is part of the Camas Conservation District. He joins us in the first half of the show to discuss the district's roles and responsibilities and some of the challenges they face as population and economies grow while water supplies become more stressed.
So that's all in the first half of the show. And then in the second half of the show, Chris and I will catch up on some news highlights and some updates from some past experiences and interviews that we've had. We're going to talk about some of the recently passed legislation in Colorado, making it the first state to regulate methane emissions associated with oil and gas drilling. And we'll also be talking about the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
We'll be talking about their latest summary report on climate change and its impacts.
Right. Some of those findings are pretty interesting. And if we have a little time, I'll summarize my visit to MetTech, the electronic e-waste recycling facility, what I saw there, and how that compared to a couple other recycling facilities that were one in particular that recently actually caught on fire. Find out if your TV burned. Later in the show.
You won't want to miss this.
Of course, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
The environment, our connections with it and impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Garrison Keillor graces the Eccles Center stage April 3rd. Known as host and creator of NPR's Prairie Home Companion, the witty Keillor spins a tale like no other. Sit back, lend an ear, and enjoy story, song, and that familiar baritone. Show starts at 7:30. Tickets start at $20. Call the above-average staff at 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, illuminating, and entertaining since 1998.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From the science of willpower to exploring the teenage brain.
From bike fit to relationship alignment.
From embracing imperfection to going gluten-free.
Join us for conversations with the experts on health, fitness, and lifestyle.
It's The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.
Park City Clinic.
Grand Valley Bank.
And Park Meadows Country Club.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And in the studio with us this morning is Jake Powell. He's the Upper Weber River Watershed Coordinator. A little bit of a mouthful. And so his work focuses on water quality and conservation, and he is here to tell us about it. So welcome to the show, Jake.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start by just talking about what your job is. What does it mean to be a watershed coordinator?
That's a great question, a question that I am frequently asked. Watershed coordinators, there's several of us throughout the state that are, our boundaries are watershed instead of county boundaries or political or geographic. So we work where the water flows. And what I do is identify projects, water quality needs, and then work with private landowners to identify problems, come up with a solution, and then implement those projects through different funding mechanisms that are either state or federal or perhaps private donations to help improve the water quality of the Upper Weber area.
So tell us who, you know, what agency or organization are you associated with?
Well, as you mentioned, I work specifically for the Camas Valley Conservation District, and you gave a great explanation of what the Conservation District is. I also work in partnership with the Division of Water Quality and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is a federal agency, also known as the NRCS. So I work with those three groups, and as a coordinator, really the name of the game is partnerships and coordination. So between those three groups and tying those agencies together, we get quite a bit of work done here in the Weber River.
I'm hoping that you all have similar missions.
Yes.
You don't conflict with each other? Okay.
Very rarely.
So generally, what is the mission then? Like you say, soil, water conservation.
Exactly.
Practices.
Exactly. The big idea for me in the Upper Weber is trying to improve the water quality is sort of the general idea, but more specifically, we have pretty specific work orders that come through certain documents, whether they're watershed plans or regulatory documents that give specific purposes and items that we're trying to target. And so through targeting those items and following along with those watershed plans, we have a pretty good roadmap of where we want to go. It's just a matter of taking the steps to get there.
So I think it's actually pretty interesting to have a position that, like you mentioned, the boundaries of your sort of focus area are natural boundaries. They're watershed boundaries rather than
county or
exactly these like sort of
city.
Municipal distinctions or but tell us why the Upper Weber River watershed, which includes like East Cannon Creek and a lot of our local water, why does that need help? How's the water doing?
That's a really good question. I think we take for granted being up in the upper portions of the watershed that we would have water quality issues. And East Canyon Creek in particular and also Silver Creek actually are identified by the state of Utah and the EPA as what's called listed, which means they don't meet their beneficial use. So each water body in the state has a beneficial use assigned to it, which means it has a reason for being, whether that's to be a fishery, whether that's to be irrigation water or municipal water. And if they don't meet the criteria for that use, they get on a list, and those lists trigger what's called a total maximum daily load process, which is an idea that comes from if it doesn't meet its beneficial use, then obviously there's a reason for that. And so these documents and these studies identify those reasons and then create a work plan to remove those streams from that quote-unquote bad list. They call it a 303D list, which is referring to the Clean Water Act.
Okay. So can a watershed have multiple beneficial uses then?
Yes.
You could be broken up into, well, like you say, fisheries, or in part is irrigation, and part of the mission is provide municipal drinking water.
Exactly. Many of the creeks have multiple beneficial uses. So there'll be a cold water fishery, irrigation water, domestic water use. So they are kind of layered, and obviously the most stringent criteria is used. And once you can meet the most stringent, obviously the rest of the criteria are met.
Okay. So what are your challenges then in your watershed?
So specifically, you know, regarding this area of the Upper Weber and more particularly with East Canyon Creek, which is kind of a big focus for the Park City area, because much of the water that runs off of the mountains, the resorts, the city ends up in East Canyon Creek. Mm-hmm. We deal a lot with nutrients, actually, phosphorus and nitrogen in particular. We also deal a lot with temperature. Those are the major issues we see on East Canyon Creek is temperature and nutrients.
Hmm.
And nutrients, I think people often hear that word and think that it's like a good thing. Nutrients,
yeah.
How can that be bad? Right?
Yeah.
Right? Sounds great.
Doesn't nature
but what,
need that?
Yeah. But explain how that functions in our stream system here.
That's a great question. So nutrients, they are – every stream and every system needs some sort of energy source or some sort of, you know, nutrient uptake. The problem is we live in a very nutrient-rich society. We've been able to create nutrients from fossil fuels in the form of, you know, obviously fertilizers. We also concentrate populations, so we end up, you know, our own wastes are considered, they have nutrients in them from
right.
The foods that we take in. And so once we exceed the natural state of a stream or a system in nutrients, then we get things like algae blooms, which then take the oxygen out of the stream, which then creates issues for fish. We have issues in our watershed where we have high phosphoric soils. So meaning there's a lot of soil types in the Park City that have high phosphorus content.
Huh.
So when we have areas where construction might be happening and sediment runs off. from those sites and go into a storm drain, which then runs into the river. We're basically putting nutrients or excess energy into the stream. And when we go past the breaking point of how much nutrients they need, and we put too many nutrients in the stream, then we end up with larger problems that cascade through the ecosystem.
Right. And, of course, another source of these nutrients, like you say, fertilizer, rich in nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. And, of course, what do we use fertilizer up here for? We shouldn't. We use it to grow our Kentucky bluegrass, right? So every time we fertilize our lawns in the spring, if there is a storm and we put too much fertilizer down, that runs off and that gets introduced into the watershed. And that's what you're talking about, that potential overloading of the watershed and the consequences associated with that, algal blooms, among other things, right?
Exactly.
So that's the series. Yeah. That's the linkages.
Yeah, and with water, you know, distance means a little bit, but it doesn't to some degree. We feel like we might live far away from the creek, but we've hooked all of our cities to the creeks through pipe networks and everything. So even if you might feel like over-fertilizing your property because you live far away from the creek is a safe bet, you know, there's some pathway that water will go somewhere, and it will end up, that's what a watershed is, obviously, is it ends up somewhere, and it ends up in our creeks. So really, what kind of the rule of thumb is, if you don't want it in your drinking water, then don't put it on the landscape because it'll end up in the water somehow.
Because that can go for pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and all the other sides that you might apply to your lawn or garden too.
Exactly.
Which is why you shouldn't, or should do your best to avoid that. Okay. Hey, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Jake Powell. He's the coordinator of the Upper Weber Watershed, part of the Camas Conservation District, which helps owners of land manage their soils and manage their water. And we said in the intro that the conservation district started as a result of all things, the Dust Bowl back in 1937 and 1938, when land was poorly managed on a colossal scale, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And some of those, you know, the roots are in soil, of course, but they've expanded to be stewards of all resources in their geographic area. We do quite a bit of work with the agricultural community, because that's sort of where their roots are, in managing agricultural resources for soil and water conservation. But obviously, in our watershed particularly, there's an urban component that needs to be worked and cooperated with as well. So we do quite a bit of work up here in the urban context as well.
So if people have a question about a local stream or the stream that runs through their yard or the storm drain on their street, can they call you to talk about what they might do to improve conditions?
Sure. That's my job, is to bridge the gap between, you know, the state and federal regulations. You know, I don't have a regulatory role in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
I have
clarifying that in case.
Which is the best part of my job, is I get to be the person that comes to address the issue and help solve the problem rather than perhaps regulate those
or
issues.
Or enforcing it. You're not the enforcer.
No. That is not in
you're
my
the compeller.
Right.
Compel people.
Yes.
To recognize the value of protecting the soil and water, or changing their practices. Because what kind of practices do you see? Like we talked about over-fertilizing or so, but with respect to farmers, there may be some of the practices they're employing that are resulting in erosion or so.
Exactly.
So you're seeing that, witnessing that with farmers and, let's say, those that raise cattle or so, or livestock. That impact. So give us some examples of the problems you see there.
Yeah, there's obviously an agricultural tradition and history within our watershed, within Summit County in general. And we see, you know, the old ways of doing things are changing, and part of it is education, part of it is a generational shift. But part of it is, you know, the first step obviously is to educate, and many of your listeners might be surprised that there are water quality issues in our watershed, because the creeks do look good. You know, they are pretty, they're cold and they're clear, but that doesn't mean they're always healthy or meeting what they need to be meeting. And so with agricultural producers, we do a lot of work creating buffers around streams, so that if there is erosion issues or runoff issues, that there's a an ecological system there to capture and filter those nutrients, which is what nature typically does. We do a lot of work with grazing management, managing the timing and intensity of a grazing practice with near a stream. And often, I mean, in the West especially, the riparian corridors are extremely viable areas. And that little strip that runs along the stream in the West is extremely visible. In the East, mm-hmm. you know, it gets blended in with the larger forest context. But these corridors that run along streams are extremely important, and so they have to be managed differently than maybe the surrounding farmland or the surrounding sagebrush areas.
Right.
So we work a lot with teaching management. We work a lot with leveraging programs that incentivize that management, that allow for perhaps a fence to be put in so that they can manage one area different than another. We do a lot of structural practices. Maybe they're, you know, in the case of East Cannon Creek, there's places where the stream banks are eroding so heavily and quickly that no change in management would change that system fast enough for us to see a water quality benefit. And so we might do a stream bank stabilization project where we shape those banks again and replant them. We do some works with changing the stream flow a little, or the stream direction, perhaps
right.
maybe away from a structure so that there's not a threat to a field or to a structure.
Right.
Because obviously streams move, and we try to work within those boundaries.
Okay.
So part of your role is working with the East Cannon Creek Watershed Committee, which, you know, full disclosure, I know because I'm on the committee and my role at Spawner Preserve. But tell us about some of the work that the committee has done, you know, over the past 5 or 10 years.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Nell. The Watershed Committee is I can't speak enough about them. And many of your listeners that may be tuned into the environmental issues that surround this area might not know that there is a group of people that are actively working on those issues. The East Canyon Watershed Committee is one of the strongest and probably not the oldest, but most established watershed committees in this area. I mean, actually, probably within the state. As far as the other watershed coordinators I work with, you know, they're the best, in my opinion.
Really? Despite Nell's obstructionist attitude, that's what I've heard.
Constantly causing problems.
I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, it's a group of volunteers that meet quarterly to help, you know, envision what they want for the watershed, to identify problems, to identify projects, to work with landowners, to be kind of a local voice for how money and time is spent within our watershed. And we have a lot of really knowledgeable people, but we also have a lot of really great grassroots people that are in the community that help us understand how best to address these issues, to find that balance between what has to be done, what needs to be done, and what wants to be done. And so that's always a tough balance to make, and the Watershed Committee really helps us out with that. And I can't speak enough to their efforts as volunteers, their technical knowledge. And if any of the listeners are interested, you know, we have a website,
yeah.
eastcanyoncreek.org,
right.
That's updated, that keeps people aware of what we're doing. Also lets people know when our meetings are. And we have a meeting coming up next week, April 10th. At 9:30 a.m. at the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District building, if anybody's interested.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous opportunity to kind of talk about water quality issues and maybe get to know some people that have an interest, because there are a lot of people in our watershed working on water quality issues, trying to improve our water quality. Because how we manage our land here is given directly to the people downstream of us, and so we have a great responsibility.
Water quality, of course, primary. What about water quantity? Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked in the intro, you know, the communities grow, economies grow, and our water supplies don't necessarily grow with them. And in some ways, some measures, they seem to be dwindling. The trends or the patterns suggest that. Are you addressing that? Do you see challenges there going forward?
That's a huge challenge, actually, Chris. I'm glad you mentioned that. Water quantity and water quality are really commingled.
Right.
And we can kind of parse them apart conceptually, but really they're one and the same. Obviously, pollutants are a function of concentration. And so the more water we have in the stream, the less concentrated those pollutants are. So mm-hmm. in the late fall or in the late summer, perhaps, when water quantities dwindle, that's when we see the worst water quality problems, you know, where every one of our decisions that we make, every little drop of pollutant that is in the stream gets amplified when we have less water. And so we do see that in this watershed. Water quantity is a major issue. Our watershed committee is working, trying some pretty innovative ways to try and deal with water rights issues, trying to consolidate water, to try and put more water in the stream. Obviously, more water in the system doesn't mean much if everybody takes more water. More water in the system only means something if it ends up in the stream. And so we've done a pretty good job. Society in general has done a good job of locking down all the water on paper. And so it becomes really difficult to try and put water back in the stream. It's sort of the long-standing tradition is that's a waste of water to see it walk past your property. It needs we live in a world where you
really
want to use
that,
it.
Yeah. That's the case.
That's sort of the way the law is written.
Any
is.
Water that goes by me is a lost opportunity
right. In
this state.
And
it's
I
not,
think
if it's
in
not
this,
put to use.
Yeah, in this watershed, our water is over-allocated.
Yes.
So that means more than 100% of our water is tied up.
So a dry creek is the best used creek. In a way.
I think that's the old way of thinking. Yeah. Things are changing. The law obviously has to follow suit, but it takes a long time to make those changes. But we are seeing some pretty substantial gains, I think, in this watershed of some real innovative efforts to try and put water back in the river. And you'd be surprised how hard that is to do. But, every person really has a stake in that. You know, we see in the summertime or have heard a lot of reports of people, putting a pump in the river and filling up a pond and everybody thinks, my straw is very small, so I don't really have that big of a – I'm only taking a few gallons. Well, you get a lot of people that do that, and all of a sudden we have really, 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 really low flows in places where we really need flows. And so everybody has a part to play in water quality and water quantity. I think a lack of information is one of the first things that everybody thinks, taking a little bit of water doesn't make a difference.
Right, that tragedy of the commons.
Exactly.
Attitude.
Exactly. And water is a common resource we all share. And so it does have a tendency to move towards a tragedy of the commons type of situation.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those straws, that people are putting into the stream. That's actually illegal. Right,
yes.
To take water out of the streams here. So because of the water rights system out west, it's so different for people who have come from the east and are used to the way that water is managed in the east, where it's abundant and that's not an issue. Out here, it's actually illegal to take water out of the stream for your own use without having a right.
That's right. And that is a good point, that we do have a lot of people, especially in this area, that may be from out of state or from the East Coast, where getting
myself
rid of water
included.
is
the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not necessarily so there is some legal ramifications for, putting your straw in the river and taking a little bit of water out.
Do you see occasions of that?
Where that happens?
Illegal taking?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I personally don't walk that. Once again, I don't have a role where I walk the stream with a badge, but there is – people have that responsibility within our watershed to be – they are – I believe they're called a deputy water commissioner or something like that.
Along those lines, yeah.
Something deputy. And they their role is to make sure that the water the water rights are being adhered to. And so – In the West, people do own water on paper, and so that has to be taken into consideration.
So if I have a right, I can draw water.
You can
some
draw
volume.
You can draw the amount of water that you have the right to in the place that you have the right to, and put it on a land that you have the right to.
Oh, okay. So very specific.
Very specific
controls there for a certain period of time too.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, do you see illegal takings?
Yeah. I've actually. Been aware of a couple in my time at the Swanner Preserve, and there are things that have been brought to our attention, or things that maybe the state water engineer brought to our attention, and and those were resolved and nobody was thrown in jail,
right?
But yeah, I've been involved in a couple since I've been here. So
wow, and maybe let's say that most of that is due to ignorance of the
and
rules.
I would say that it definitely is. In both of these cases, it's definitely been people like, oh, I didn't realize we couldn't do that. I
thought I could pull a half a million gallons of water a day for without,
right,
not,
for
without
our,
being a
you know, water feature in the garden. Or,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
So I was going to kind of ask, let's talk funding for these projects. You know, you're talking about a lot of work that you've been able to do in conjunction with the watershed group or the conservation districts, but where do you get the money to do these projects?
That's always the question in everyone's mind, right?
Is, yeah.
We all have great ambitions, but how do we pay for these great ambitions? And really it is about partnerships. If there's a will, usually we can find the funding to do a good project. There's a lot of money that comes from the EPA through to the Division of Water Quality, which they provide grant opportunities. Obviously, there's a matching component, meaning somebody either needs to bring cash to the table, or we call it in-kind match, which means sort of sweat labor, sweat equity. And so typically we found that when we have a landowner or a group that has a really valid concern and they have a project that is holistic and in its scope and does benefit water quality, there the money will flow to that. There's money that comes. The state actually has a fund that is interest from, I believe it's wastewater treatment plant loans, gets recirculated back, and they address non-point source pollution with that. So there's funding opportunities through the state, there's funding opportunities through the federal government, and there's opportunities, a lot of really great partners that manage water in our watershed throw money at good projects as well. I mean, it's in their best interest to have high quality water that comes into their inlet pipes. And so, you know, they look upstream to try and improve the water quality, which means when it comes to their pipe, they obviously have less filtration, less. So it really benefits, you know, the bottom line bills.
Okay, let's take a quick break. We're at the bottom of the hour. Got a couple underwriters in. We come back. We'll have a few more questions for Jake Powell, the coordinator of the Upper Weber Watershed, part of the Camas Conservation District. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. And we're speaking with Jake Powell. He's the coordinator of the Upper Weber Watershed. Hear that new song?
Yeah, we're re-energized. We got the music back. We're feeling good.
Love that song.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jan. Jake Powell is the coordinator of the Upper Weber Watershed and part of the Camas Conservation District. We got a chatting all about water quality and water quantity issues associated with at least that watershed, and I'm sure it follows for many other watersheds around the state. Give us a couple minutes about your background. Like, how did you get into this job? What's your educational background?
That's a funny question.
Okay.
I've always been interested in water and always wanted to do stream restoration type work, deal with rivers, deal with habitats and riparian areas, but I never was quite sure how to do it. So my actual background is in landscape architecture and environmental planning. I did a degree at Utah State with a minor in watershed science that sort of allowed me to build up some of the knowledge and tools of water. and stream work. And then I worked for a little while and went back to do my graduate work also in landscape architecture with a master's of science, but I focused and worked in an outreach center that was the Center for Watershed Stewardship at Penn State. And at that time, we did, you know, basically what I do today. We worked with landowners, we developed projects, we wrote grants. And so it was really real grounded, real life experience that helped me come to this job. And I'm from this area originally. And so the ability to come back and sort of, you know, invest again in the future of our communities and my own kids was a real gift.
Well, good.
And so it's nice. I mean, it's a great job. It's the best job I've ever had. You know, I get to do what I love to do. I get to be outside. I get to work with people. I get to work with people like the Swanner Eco Center and groups that, you know, are aligned with larger long-term goals that are good for the environment, good
right.
for society. And so, you know, it's a real gift to be able to do something you love every single day. But the route to get there was sort of serendipitous.
Well, that's what it typically is
in all of our
careers. We're all environmental professionals in one form or another. So we're always curious about the background. And of course, when you were at Penn State, that, like you say, they have completely different water issues back there.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes they have, you know, it's not enough. It's plenty of.
Yeah.
You know, so, well, good. Give us another summary then about the website where people can go to learn more about what you're doing.
Yeah. We are looking for local knowledge, for local input. And so, the Watershed Committee might be the best way to get to me. It's eastcanyoncreek.org.
Mm-hmm.
That's the website. Typically on the left side is my contact information. Once again, I'm Jake, and you can shoot me an email, give me a phone call, and we can talk about issues. Or, you know, I do a lot of outreach and education. If there's an opportunity at a school or a group, you know, Boy Scout groups, people that want to learn about water quality or learn about these issues, you know, face-to-face with learn about what a watershed is, how it functions, learn about issues in our own watershed, I'm more than happy to. That's part of my job description is to provide an educational opportunity to people so that people are more knowledgeable about, obviously, their impacts and the issues that we have in this watershed.
Great. Yeah, you gave a great little presentation to the Summit County Council a few weeks ago. That's where I saw you, and they were very appreciative of the knowledge you provided them of what you do. And the conservation districts have websites too, right? And learn about all the 38 different conservation. What do you know that website?
You could just. I think it's UACD.org,
yes.
UACD, which stands for the Utah Association of Conservation Districts. It's the larger group that kind of knits everybody together.
Okay.
Yep.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today,
Jake. It's a
pleasure
to be here. I appreciate the time and the ability to talk about some of the resources and things we can bring to this watershed.
Fantastic.
All right. Let's take another break for a couple underwriters, and we come back. We've got a bunch of news items to cover, including Colorado's recent passing of legislation, which will do a better job at regulating oil and natural gas industry in that state. A little update on the IPCC latest report and my visit to MedTech Electronic Waste Recyclers. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after this.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to The Restore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to The Restore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Garrison Keillor graces the Eccles Center stage April 3rd. Known as host and creator of NPR's Prairie Home Companion, the witty Keillor spins a tale like no other. Sit back, lend an ear, and enjoy story, song, and that familiar baritone. Show starts at 7:30. Tickets start at $20. Call the above-average staff at 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, illuminating, and entertaining since 1998.
Hi, this is Alyssa Daly with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. All-in-one recycling is used in Summit County. Recyclables go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. Each week we talk about environmental issues, topics, concerns, concepts of sustainability, and
we've got going with that list there, Chris.
Yeah, it goes gross.
What else? So, yeah.
Well, we got 15 minutes to talk about some news items.
That's right.
And issues and let's get started.
That's right. So the first one we're going to cover involves one of our neighboring states, Colorado, and they recently became, at the end of February, the first state to regulate methane emissions associated with oil and gas drilling. And I think the impetus for this was, an increased issue in air quality in the urban issues of Colorado with a variety of different things, and methane is contributing to that. Methane is, of course, also a greenhouse gas that's 20 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. So if you're concerned about climate change...
I'm sorry.
Are we going to have a little physics, chemistry session here?
I just want to quickly explain, why is methane a more, quote-unquote, powerful or stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide? And the number is, 20, 22,
yeah,
depending on its age. Some people cite it to be 70 or 80 times. It varies with the length of time that methane is in the atmosphere. Basically, it's because it's molecular shape. It's a carbon surrounded by four hydrogens, and it seems symmetrical when you draw it on a paper, right? It's a C with four hydrogens attached to it. But it's asymmetrical in its shape and its three-dimensional form. And that asymmetry allows it to absorb infrared light much better than carbon dioxide, which is a carbon with just two oxygens, but oxygens fashioned in also an asymmetrical fashion. So the more asymmetrical and the longer the carbon chain is, the more it has the ability to absorb infrared light, heat. And that's why methane is a better, has a stronger affinity to absorb infrared heat, infrared light or heat. So there you go. And as you get out into the chlorofluorocarbons, those are incredibly long strings of compounds. They are also greenhouse gases, et cetera. And that's why oxygen is not a greenhouse gas, because it's O2 and it's symmetrical. Thank you very much.
Fact of the day.
I'm out of here.
College knowledge.
You picked the rest.
Take the day off, Chris.
I read a book. So I'm sorry. Parenthetically speaking, that's what's going on with methane.
That was a footnote. But that's good to know, because it's something that we hear about all the time.
Yeah,
it's this is more powerful.
More powerful. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're doing better efforts at controlling that.
Right. And so Colorado has become the first state to take this on. So that's kind of groundbreaking. They've set the bar. But the process to which they got there was interesting. And this past fall, we talked about how they were considering this, and it seemed like they had some industry support, and nobody knew quite what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the really interesting situation is that the Environmental Defense Fund drafted this legislation working with some of these massive energy companies, like
what?
Anadarko, like Encana, like Noble Energy. They sat down at the table.
Adversaries.
Right, and talked about something that would kind of work for everybody. And what the representatives from these companies are saying is, hey, this is a kind of a great public relations piece as
right.
Opposition is growing to their companies. They want to say that they are doing something and trying to do their best. And they're also saying, hey, if you set this level bar and we all have to do it, then we're happy to do it. And we actually want to do it, because the methane that they're losing on these sites is basically product. They're losing
commodity,
losing money as it leaves. And so they're losing methane in the transportation process of the their product right now,
right.
And also right at the site
where they're
drilling or at the wellhead.
There's leaks.
And this can be detected with infrared cameras. You can see it.
Right.
So this legislation is going to require that be measured, that there's, a 2-week time period to fix something if a leak
right.
is detected. And it And they're required to capture 95% of what's leaking. So it's relatively stringent.
Yeah. And so there are consequences, as any regulatory requirements, there's consequences if they don't follow through on those things. But they, like you say, now they have incentives to do that now.
Right.
And they're the first state in the country to do something like this. So hopefully that kind of sets the groundwork and the foundation for other states to see the value of this. And similar legislation.
Right. And, you know, we've talked up this industry partnership, which is very cool, of course, but other industry trade groups and other companies like Chevron, you know, really put the full court press on opposing this legislation or trying to dilute it, you know, only having it go into place in urban areas or only having it go into place for large drilling sites. But the, you know, the whole thing got passed, but it probably won't be easy. to pass this in other situations.
In other Oklahoma or Texas or North Dakota.
Or Utah, for that matter.
Or Utah, you know, it'll be a little more – Colorado has a little more progressive attitude towards these things. So good for them.
Yeah.
Somebody has to be the first.
Right.
That's how these things get started in the environmental arena. Okay. Let's turn our attention to the next story, which is let's say the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change – their most recent report was, well, leaked. It hasn't even been formally released yet, but it got, of course, no surprise, parts of it or all of it got leaked. And basically, it's becoming more, would you say, now I was going to say, they're becoming more alarmist. Or they're trying
the word
to get
alarmist.
All right.
Here's my take.
Okay.
In past reports, they've really been focused on like still trying to prove that climate change is taking place. And they're just so focused on the science of climate change. And yes, it's happening. And this is why everybody needs to understand that. And here's the science. And now they're like, they've gone beyond that.
Yeah,
if you're
done.
If you don't have an understanding of this basic science concept, too bad. Okay, we're leaving
we're
you behind
on.
Because we are talking about impact.
We're done
now.
Talking to the tinfoil hat brigade out there.
Yeah.
We're just moving on.
Right.
And then this report now focuses on what some of the consequences they're seeing.
Right. And they're saying we're already seeing these consequences. They are in progress. We are already dealing with them. And it's, you know, it's cool. They give examples.
And here's some of the examples. Yeah. On the PBS NewsHour last night, they actually interviewed Michael Oppenheimer, one of the co-authors, Princeton professor, and Patricia Lankow. Of the also another author of this recent report of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. And that's interesting, too, because the NewsHour also has kind of moved on from having somebody from the quote-unquote opposition
right,
there to,
the,
you know, to question
debate.
The findings or the efforts. They're done with that, too. So here's what Oppenheimer and Lankow kind of summarize what they're seeing. Crop yields are changing. There is quantifiable evidence that crop yields around the globe are changing, i.e. becoming less.
Right. Food production is being impacted.
Right. And they're not seeing crop yields improving in other parts of the globe. The deaths due to heat waves are increasing, they said. They have quantifiable evidence in the last 5 to 10 years that more and more people are dying due to heat waves. And then the Arctic, there's quantifiable evidence that the trends and the patterns that Arctic sea ice is declining year over almost year over year, but on a fairly consistent basis, particularly during the summer. And ocean pH levels
right.
in the ocean are decreasing, so the oceans are becoming more acidic. So those are some of the quantifiable
right.
evidence that climate change is starting to bear its effects and consequences on the planet and us.
Right. And I was going to say one of the other interesting parts of this, I think, is that they talked about, you know, sort of who's most vulnerable and who's most likely to be impacted. And, you know, they're saying that a lot of the risk is obviously focused in urban areas with, you know, big weather events mm-hmm. and, you know, infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also saying, though, that many of the people that will be impacted the most heavily are those that are already struggling with other issues. So they live in, you know, undeveloped areas. They don't have access to the resources we do. You know, it's areas where they're dealing with poverty and hunger and these kinds of issues already. And now they're going to kind of also be hit with climate change. So I think it was the World Bank presented a number saying that developing nations will need $100 billion to sort of help adapt to climate change. And developed nations like the U.S. and others actually fought to get that number taken out of the report for policymakers because they don't want to be responsible for providing $100 billion to the nations that are dealing with the climate change that we mostly created.
Right, right. We don't have that kind of money.
Right.
Just or don't do have we? It right now.
Well, or where are we putting it?
Or where? Yes. Where is this going to go? So, see, here's the encouraging thing that at least Oppenheimer and Lankow talked about. You know, this concept of mitigation and adaptation. You can do both. We're not doing so well in the mitigation part, but adaptation. They are seeing a number of countries that are starting to implement policies that address adaptation, that promote adaptation, and the U.S. is one of them. They also complimented the Obama administration on acts of mitigation with respect to coal-fired power plants and trying to reduce carbon emissions in those areas. But states like New York are now implementing more programs in the area of adaptation to prevent another calamity and catastrophe associated with Hurricane Sandy. So they're spending billions of dollars to reinforce their infrastructures to account for the anticipated changes that are going to be coming along. So adaptation is playing an important role, and people are slowly getting it.
Yeah, or maybe quickly getting it at this point, I would like to think. But this also talks about economic impacts, and I think that might be an area that might grab the attention of some people that haven't been looking at this issue as an economic, as an impact.
Well, it's that I think the full report is going to be released shortly. So we can
it's
out already?
Yeah, I think the full report and the policymaker summary are both posted online.
So it's no longer leaked. It's actually out now. It was leaked earlier this weekend. Okay. All right. Last few minutes.
You went to MedTech.
Yeah, I went to MedTech. We had Scott Kay on, one of the reps for MedTech. They are an e-waste recycling facility. They just concentrate on electronic waste, your TVs, your phones, your computers, your laptops, anything with a circuit board. They will consider your appliances for recycling. And so he was on the show a few weeks ago talking about their facility, their processes, their challenges, what they do with all this stuff. And so I went down to the facility a couple of weeks ago and spent a couple hours just walking around. It's impressive. The takeaway here, they do great work. And full disclosure, I'm not an employee. I'm not a consultant with them. I was just observing this facility with respect to other facilities other recycling facilities I visited.
Sure, and they also sort of talked about their open door policy. If you want to come visit their site, you can come visit their site. They're not trying to hide anything. You know, there are no.
Yeah, they'll have school groups come through. That's MedTech, M-E-T-E-C-H .com, I think, or just search on them and you'll find their Utah facility and you can get in touch with them. They are clean. Everything they have is indoors. All right. So a lot of recycling facilities have so much stuff that they start storing things outside, and that has a series of potential consequences, which is what happened in a recycling facility down in electronic recycling facility down in Parowan that caught fire back in early March, on March 2nd. No one knows quite reason why it caught fire, but all of these TVs and stuff that were stored outside caught fire one afternoon, and that's a bad thing. When electronics and plastics catch fire, that is a toxic pollutant that's being generated to the soil and to the air. And the fire was put out, but now they've got a series of problems. And when I worked in a Superfund program, a number of Superfund sites were old recycling facilities. That's what they were called, quote unquote.
That's scary.
Recycling fit. So anyway, MedTech does great work. Recycle Utah up here uses MedTech. Summit County Landfill uses MedTech. So kudos to them and Scott Kay and his group. And they you would not believe how many TVs there are.
That's yeah, like give us a picture of this facility. There you walk inside.
And it's a warehouse is about almost 2 acres in size. Okay.
That's
70,000 square plus or minus. And I would say that 75% of that is TVs. And I'm not talking about TVs that are 15 years old.
Like mine.
Yeah. I'm talking about TVs that are 5 or 6 years old. Okay. These are TVs that are still in working condition that they get. But they try to reprocess them or find other markets. But their market is to break these things down and recycle the raw materials from them or that come out of them. So we generate insane amount. And these are giant TVs. These are these old 55-inch back-paneled or CRT screens. Do we need so many TVs? No. I'm going around. But so many TVs are recycled there. So
interesting.
That's the majority. And they take laptops and hard drives and
smartphones
and those things. And some of those are reprocessed too.
Yeah.
That they can. So anyway, that's the visit down to MedTech Recyclers. You can learn more about the Stonecastle Recycling Facility fire down in Parowan, Utah. You can search on that and find out what's going on with that. Let's take another break for some underwriters. We come back, we'll start to wrap up, give you a little teaser on what's coming on the mountain life tomorrow. Stay tuned. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage services and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Recycling in Summit County is improving. The trick to remember? Recyclable materials go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We've got time to wrap up. We got a calendar event item.
That's right. Yeah, we have a stargazing event at the Swanner Eco Center on Thursday night at 7 p.m. And this will be...
It's not dark at 7.
Well, there's a talk first. So you can learn about, you know,
what you're going to be,
what you're going to be doing. So Paul Ricketts is going to be leading. He's with the University of Utah Observatory. First, he's going to be talking about his research on like light pollution and its impacts on both people and then on our natural ecosystems.
Huh.
And then there will be guided stargazing with these massive telescopes that they bring, which is always kind of fun.
Really?
And so that's 7 p.m. on Thursday. $5 a person or free for members. As usual.
And fingers crossed that it's not cloudy.
I know. Fingers crossed for decent weather. So
it looks like the weather. Oh, there's only a 20% chance of snow.
Hey, that's pretty good for us right now.
Actually, it's supposed to clear up Thursday night. There you go.
Fantastic.
So, all right. So that's the calendar event. What do we have for tomorrow's?
Tomorrow on The Mountain Life with Tim Henney and Lynn Ware Peak. You will hear from Spike Carlson on the Book of Building Projects. You'll hear from Ann Ober on the Mountain Accord. And you'll hear about the academic decathlon from the high school who's headed to the national, you know, finals in Hawaii.
What?
I know. The mountain life. It's all, you know, they cover everything.
Who's going to Hawaii?
Academic decathlon winners from the high school.
Well, you know what? That... Being smart pays.
That's right.
There you go.
That's right.
Be smart. Go to Hawaii. All right. Hey, let's start to wrap up the show. First, let's thank Jake Powell from the Upper Weber Watershed, part of the Camas Conservation District, talking about what he does there for soil and water conservation practices.
That's right. And, of course, we want to thank our underwriters for making our show possible. They are Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Vail Resorts.
Rocky Mountain Power.
And as always, San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate.
You can join us on Facebook if you like what we're doing. You'll get updates and additional information. That's KPCW This Green Earth.
Or email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you all again next week.